Well, I was born in Mexico.
Dog Creek or Volga. I was on a farm, and I was living with my grandparents at the time. My mother was, I should say, was living with my grandparents at the time. My father was overseas, World War I. That's where I was born. And since then, and when I was about 3 or 4 years old, we moved back to the city at that time.
What was the city like at that time?
Well, when you're 3 and 4 years old, who's to say what it's like? It was a lot bigger now than it was then, it's mm-hmm. that way. And, the first outbreak, when I met my dad, you see, I couldn't speak anything but Icelandic at the time. And he was English. So it was a little difficulty there, but we overcame that. Once I moved back to the city, we went to English school. And all the schools we went to, first where we lived, I don't know. I know we lived for a while in Port Rouge, Sturgeon Creek, Winnipeg. We're always on them in those days.
What schools did you go to?
Oh, goodness. Well, I think I began school at Gladstone. And from there we went out to Valentine School. Then we moved back to city, as I remember it. Now, there might be one or two in between, I don't know where. But Wellington, then General Wolfe, and a part of Daniel, and that was it.
Were you in the militia before the outbreak of the Second World War?
Oh, yeah. I was with the 10th Machine Gunners.
And what was your rank?
Private. And we met every Thursday. We had fun. Then they amalgamated with the Grenadiers later on.
And
I sort of dropped out of it then. But my name was still on the rank. Mm-hmm. If you know what I mean.
Yeah.
In that sense.
And were you working at this time?
Well, I took odd jobs in the summer, mostly, and till I was older, on the farms.
What type of farms did you work on?
Mixed farming, mostly.
What type of jobs did you do?
Oh, anything that was asked. Didn't matter what it was. See, out there you have to be rather universal. You could do everything. Mm-hmm. Whether it's milking a cow or driving a horse or chasing steers up the field or something. You got to do it.
Now, the outbreak of war, when did you join the Grenadiers?
September the 10th, 1939.
And in what rank? Was it a private?
Private.
Okay. And what barracks were you at this time?
We were in Minto Barracks. Mm-hmm. We're living at home.
Mm-hmm. And what type of training was done?
Oh, the usual, up and down the field, parade square work, and rifle training, machine gun training. And most of us at that time, I would say safely to say, that most of us had had this training before.
Okay. Now, the Grenadiers went to Jamaica.
Yes, that was in the early 40s, spring of 40, we went to Jamaica.
And what do you remember about the trip, Winnipeg to Jamaica? How did you travel, by boat or?
Well, no, we traveled. We did travel by boat, but first we started here, and we went down to Halifax by train. And there was all kinds of guesswork: where are you going? What are you doing? So we hit Halifax. And the boat was right in front of us. And these dock workers were saying, well, have some fun down in Jamaica when you get there. We didn't know till the dock workers told us. They knew before we did where we were going. See, this was the big secret. Everybody knows what you're going to do, but you do. But the boat ride down there was very nice. We traveled, you might say, first class. They hadn't converted all the boats then into troop carriers. You had waiters on the boat, something we'd never seen. And, breakfast, it was served at your table. You didn't line up, you know. It was something out of this world.
Were there civilians on the boat along with the troops?
Just the crew.
Just the crew?
Yeah.
And did you make any stops along the way?
Oh, yes, we stopped at Bermuda. Let off a company of men there.
Okay. Now, your arrival in Jamaica, what was this like?
Well, I would say there was quite a bit of work to be done, but it was like a holiday. Never seen the country before. You were so busy looking. You never seen natives carry bananas or anything like that, you see. This was like a big holiday, but we enjoyed the work at the same time, watching them.
What company were you with at this time?
I was with C.
C.
I stayed with C all the way through.
And what duties were done in Jamaica?
Oh, mostly guard duty. Outside of the ordinary routine camp duties. Mm-hmm. Kitchen fatigue and so on, and clean up and everything else. But it was mostly guard duty. Guard and prisoner warden, believe it or not.
And what was the life like there? Was there any meeting with the regular civilians population there?
Oh, yes. There was a lot of meetings with them. And we were just garrison troops, that's all we were. And we were, a lot of boys were invited out to different functions. And Sunday school picnics or whatever they had on the beaches, you'd see different ports. And then you went and had your barbecued goats and everything else, and whatever they were part of the meal. It was very nice. We enjoyed it. I enjoyed 16 months of it. I'm just sorry we couldn't spend 4 years there.
Okay, you left Jamaica in about mid-1941.
Yeah, we came back here, I think, in September, landed in Winnipeg.
Mm-hmm. And what happened when you arrived in Winnipeg?
Well, we were stationed at what they call the Robinson Building at. And we were given furlough. Fine, I enjoyed, I think, about 2, maybe 3 weeks furlough. And in the meantime, you had to report in periodically to see the duty rosters had to be done. And filled and so on. And I was, I guess, one of the forces. I had about 3 days tour duty through the 2 or 3 weeks I was here. Then we were re-equipped with new equipment, new clothes, new everything. It was really nice.
And then your furlough was canceled.
Yeah, it was canceled, well, not overnight, I wouldn't say that. Because it took them a week, to round up everybody, notify them to report back to duty.
What were your feelings at this time?
Well, at that time, when we were notified that we're moving out again, we were re-equipped by this time, and we're moving out. Well, the first thing we thought of was, well, we're going overseas again. We knew that. We were scheduled for it. We volunteered. And we thought, well, probably England. But then when we get on the CPR and head west, you can't go to England. Unless they had the Atlantic so blocked that you couldn't get there, I don't know. But we figured that out.
What was the trip to Vancouver like? Did anything happen along the way that you remember?
No, I can't say anything spectacular happened. It was just an ordinary train ride, and you had bunks to sleep in, you know, like the sleepers. They were good to us. The railroad were good.
Was there any stops made along the way?
Oh, they stopped off and on here and there. I don't know the stops they made to refuel or water, whatever they'd done. And we shook hands with people and talked, and, you know, it's ordinary sorts of what I guess, going through the small town.
Now, you arrived in Vancouver. Now, what happened after your arrival there?
Well, the train landed, drove right up to the docks. And then we embarked there. Well, we seen the boat, and we figured, oh, that's it. It was the Awatea. We all boarded the boat, and, you know, there was a little rumpus there. They figured we were too crowded. The boat wasn't big enough to handle 2 battalions and a plus headquarters outfit and everything else. We were really crowded. We had hammocks. And we slept on the bed, on the tables. We slept all over, wherever you wanted to throw you. But I can't say that they really had anything to grumble about at the moment.
And did you leave Vancouver right away, or did you
We didn't leave right away. After we were all on board, and this ruckus started, we were too crowded. Everybody started striking, more or less. I guess in today's language, we struck. And so what do? They pull anchors away up, and away we go out into the bay. And we stayed overnight on the bay, so they couldn't get to shore. See, they had you. But then we pulled out the next morning, and there were still grumbles, but really, if they'd have thought at the moment, it was part of living at that time.
Yeah.
You're a troops, you're moving.
Now, did you go back into dock?
No, they wouldn't take us back into dock. Mm-hmm. They just pulled out without any say-so or anything. They just went, mm-hmm. got orders to go, pull out. And there's where we left a lot of equipment on shore. And it followed, supposed to come right behind us on another ship. Mm-hmm. And they never did catch up to us. They left it all, as I understand, in the Philippines. Or Singapore, you know. Couldn't get to us by that time. All our equipment.
What was the trip like to Hong Kong, and were any stops made along the way?
Oh yes, we made stops. As far as the trip goes, it's rather a novelty. We were crowded, as I say. We had our little gun sessions, or training sessions, as they call it, on ship, you know. Little platoons here and platoons there, maybe 10, 12 men, and around a machine gun, and explained it to us. And
what type of gun was it?
We had all trained, good training, as far as the weapons go that we had. Like, we had the Lewis gun, that was the old machine gun. That was obsolete by then, but we didn't know it. And the Bren gun, that was a good little weapon. And then they brought us a new one, and it was the Tommy gun. We'd never seen one. We'd read about them and seen them in pictures from gangsters. And there's where I can say I first came in contact with the Tommy gun. And they taught us how to handle it, how to load it, how to fix it, how to do everything in these little groups. And even at that, they were limited how many Tommy guns they had. And if you were lucky, you got one to study on. You see.
Mm-hmm. Now, the stops along the way, where did you
go? We stopped at Honolulu, going there.
And what was done there? Just
refueling and maybe picked up some food. I don't know what they picked up on the edges, but it was mostly for refueling and so on. They wouldn't let us off. We couldn't even walk in the dark, but they opened a hatch on one side. We could swim in their bay. If you wanted to, you know, but they had guards on. Even the Americans had guards on the shore. That we were forbidden to land. We were hostile. In other words, we were at war. They weren't at that time. And they showed us a lot of fun. They even had dancers out on the docks there, hula dancers and so on. They brought us entertainment. We had to watch from the ship. They were very good to us, really, in that respect. Then from there we went on to, and we landed in, next dock was Manila.
And what was done there?
I think more refueling. Maybe they picked up some more fruit. I have no idea just what they picked up, because we weren't in stores at the time. We were just having fun on the deck. And we watched them, because actually we were so used to seeing those type of natives from Jamaica. It was nothing to us. It was no novelty to see them. They were working just like the people did in Jamaica. They toted things on their shoulders or on their head, and we had seen it for 16 months prior. So really, it was no novelty. And I would say the biggest incident, I can go back now, between, my memory serves me right now, it's between Honolulu and Manila. We were on ship's guard. We all had to stand our share and guard, you know, watching for submarines and ships. And a submarine was spotted. Now, whether it was between Vancouver and Honolulu, or Honolulu and Manila, I don't know. I'm not sure on that depth. But they did spot it that night. And our other escort, the Prince someone, Robert or Prince, I don't know who it was now, they went over, checked it. They had a company of men on, soldiers also. They were our escort going across. And they checked it out, and here it turned out to be an American submarine following us. So everything was fine and dandy, and then we left Manila. Now we're back in Manila now. And between Manila and Hong Kong, now I don't know how many hours or days we sailed from there, but the Japanese fleet was sighted, heading south. There was about six or seven boats, big boats, in the horizon, and no one paid any attention to it. We saw the warning. We seen them. And there was, I don't think they even paid any attention to it. Everybody probably just figured, well, it's just maneuvers. We say we haven't been at war with Japan then. Mm-hmm. After we hit, they were sighted. Then we landed in Hong Kong. Well, I don't know, really know what to think of it, outside of a little bit of excitement. You know, you were in somewhere different. Mm-hmm. You were halfway around the world, and this was something. See, we were adventurers more.
Was any announcement ever made on the boat as to where you were going?
After we were on the boat, yes. It was made. Mm-hmm. We knew we were heading to China. But we just figured it was just some more garrison duty. See, at that time, you got to remember, we were not at war with Japan. Mm-hmm. It was after we landed that it happened.
Yeah.
And they had a feeling, I believe you can say, they had a feeling that something was going to happen, because they were allies of Germany at the time. And because we were trained that, well, if the worst comes to worst, we're going to fight our way to shore. We were being trained on board for that, like these Tommy guns, machine guns would go right in. But as it happened, we docked. It was very nice, big hotel there, the Peninsula Hotel, and standing there, we figured it was quite a nice little place. This was in Kowloon, we docked. It wasn't in Hong Kong, it was in Kowloon.
On the mainland?
On the mainland, yes. And, well, I don't know, we made an awful poor showing, I think, to march to barracks. We had the Scottish bagpipes, and we were never trained under those. I think we made an awful poor showing to the people how we marched. But, after in camp, there were a whole bunch of us given for duties, like as usual in any camp. And I had to get back on the truck. We went back to the ship, and we had to unload all the cargo and the kit bags, load them on trucks, and get them going back to camp. And from at night, I can remember seeing the island there, and beautiful lights all the way up. It was such a pretty sight at night, because the homes and that, they had different colored lights in there outside, and it was really pretty.
Now, was any training done after your arrival in Hong Kong?
Oh, yes.
And what type?
The usual training, I'd say parade word, square. And of course, you always have fatigues to do, no matter where you are. And then, that is the first time I ever fired a Tommy gun. We were all given a crack at it. Go up to on the other side of the barracks, and they had the range there, and they showed you how a Tommy gun acts when you fire it, and I found out how it acts. You see, this is the ordinary training we had.
Mm-hmm. Do you think they could have given you better training after your arrival there?
Not really. I think they'd done the best we could, in the sense that they were not expecting the type of warfare that was coming, you see. And that could have been the breaking point. You see, the element of surprise in any war is the victory at the end. If you can surprise them, you beat them. And I think they did. They taught us guerrilla warfare. They taught us everything in the hills. We manned the hills in Hong Kong, mind you, day here, 2 days. You went to pillboxes and everything else, where you're going to look over. But as far as firing goes, no, they didn't give us any firing. They didn't do anything in that sense. Just showed us where the pillbox was, the trail that led to numbers 4 and 5, whatever the pillbox number was. You know, you were stationed there and that was it.
But were the pillboxes like, I guess, designed, oh, and were they solidly made?
Oh, they were solid, don't get me wrong, but they weren't solid to the equipment they had. Mm-hmm. Let's put it that way. A naval gun could blast you right out of there. In fact, I got to the point of hating them. They could land a shell a mile away from you, but you want to get out of there. You swear it landed right on top of you. That was my only problem. I shouldn't be out in the hills laying on my stomach. Because there, you can hear it properly. And you can see what's going on around you. But in there, you've got a little window, and you're only limited in what's happening. See? And another thing that bugged me, like, this is after they, well, I say after they landed. Maybe I'm going too fast for you.
No.
But after they landed, we didn't have an aircraft in the sky. They had 4 or 5. Little things. I mean, to us today, it'd be moths. But they could get up there, and you couldn't hit them, and they were directing artillery fire from back. You see. And we didn't even have an anti-aircraft gun that could hit them. You see. That is what hurt.
Now, the actual battle itself, it started on December the 8th?
To us, it was December the 8th.
Yeah.
To you, it was December the 7th.
7th, yeah. Now, where were you when the bombing first started?
I was in camp.
And what was your reaction to it?
Well, it was, if I remember right, it was either Sunday or Monday morning. Now, I'm not sure. I can look back and find out, but we were all getting ready at that time, packing our stuff. We were going over to maneuver on the island again. We figured through pillboxes and maneuver down the hill and find out our positions and where the roads led. You know, usual stuff. Then these planes came over, about 12. We seen them. We thought, holy smokes, there's our aircraft, there's our Air Force. We thought it was ours, no warning, nothing. Next thing you know, a building goes up in front of you, and the next one comes over here. Next thing, we start running. What the heck are they doing to us? Then we find out we're at war.
Was an announcement actually made, or is it?
It just went through fast. Well, you can say it was an announcement, but it went through faster than telephone.
Mm-hmm.
Through the camp, we were attacked.
Now, what were your orders, and where did you get them from, like after the...
Well, it came from the... No, I can't really say who was left in camp, but probably the colonel of the regiment, or the brigadier, whoever it was in camp at the time. He sent out orders, everybody carry just what they can carry, no more. We left a lot of stuff there. Kit bags full of, like, our tobacco and our nice clothes and everything. And we were to get on this ferry. So we got our everything packed in our little pack sacks on our back and got up to the guardhouse there, and they were handing out ammunition. So they handed me 28 rounds of ammunition. I had to protect myself. Not bandoliers, it was 20 rounds. Go and protect yourself. So fine, we put them in, and we got orders then, I did at least, not to put any in my rifle till I got on the ferry. So when I got on the ferry, we were overcrowded, way over. But we had to get over to the island where the rest of the body, where the men were.
Were the men organized when they were going over to the island itself? Or were they just running down to the landing? And
just get down to the landing. That was the idea.
Mm-hmm.
Get on the boat, get on the island, join up with your outfit. Well, I ended up a few miles away from where I was trained. I was in new territory. I didn't know the roads. I didn't know anything. I knew there were pillboxes around.
Mm-hmm.
And we commandeered a house there, a beautiful home, English home. And we used that as headquarters. And from there, we operated out on patrols at night and in the daytime.
Whereabouts did you patrol? Was it on one of the hills, or was it one of the gaps?
Oh, hills and gaps. You just patrol the road and watch what's going on and catch who can.
Did you have a certain area to cover, or you just...
Oh, no, we had certain areas to cover. Well, whether it was big enough or not, I don't know. And then at night, you'd done guard duty at junctions and on roads and stop anything that's coming that shouldn't be on the road at night and so on and so forth. And then we were more or less termed the flying squad. Wherever they needed us, we went. We were out of camp. Our company was already in the hills, but I never did see them after action.
Now, how long did you operate from this private home? Was this the
whole
length of the...
No.
The battle?
Oh, no. The first morning they landed, we... the whole platoon went. In fact, I think two platoons went. We went to Jardine Lookout. That was our point. They were sent up there by orders, get up to Jardine Lookout. So we went up there. It took us just about all night to find where Jardine Lookout was. And when we got there, we stayed. And we were trapped up there. Couldn't get out of there. We couldn't get out anywhere except straight down a hill when we escaped at night. And there's where we lost, I would say, a good 40% of our boys. That day they were just picking them off, and then this plane over there, and then the shells would come again, and as soon as the plane came, he could see you down there, and you knew what was coming. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't shoot back because you couldn't see them even. But they had us on the hilltop, and they were coming in. That's then on the east side of the hill, I believe it was, you could see the east side, to me it was, in the valley there, that's where A Company was wiped out. And about 3 p.m, I remember my chum and I, we climbed on top of the point of the hill and we looked over and you could see bodies all over the field. We thought, oh, this is it. And we could see the Japanese congregating over there farther to our right. Mm-hmm. We went back, told them, well, we couldn't touch them anyway. What we had up there, we just had rifles and machine guns. And we could see, because we knew our boys and how they were clothed. There were an awful lot of Japanese also taking toll there, because they had charged down the valley. Mm-hmm. And our boys stood ground, and they were wiped out there nearly. And that's where the decision more or less came in about 3 or 4 in the afternoon that we had to get out of there. We were surrounded.
Mm-hmm. What date would this be?
I would say this would be around the... Oh, gosh, when did they land? 25th, that would be about the 15th, 16th, 17th, in around there. Whenever they landed, that night, that next day, yes, was when this happened.
And you received orders to evacuate this area?
From our officer in charge.
Mm-hmm. And where were you told to go?
Just to do our best and get a home, get out.
Okay.
And we did.
And where did you go?
Well, we couldn't go down the hill, we couldn't go up the hill, so we went in between them, down the hill, between both roads. And it was a steep hill.
And did you encounter any Japanese?
Not a bit, no. We did not. They hadn't cut between us, because over, I'd say about a mile away, we could see the Indian troops there, the artillery. And over here, it's the English troops on the road, guarding the road. We could see them from up in the hill. And we were coming round between them.
And what did happen after you got down the hill?
Well, after we got down the hill, we met the English troops, and they had a machine gun nest there ready and talking to us. They gave us cigarettes and told us the short road to take to get there and where we wanted to go. Mm-hmm. But then we cut into a hospital.
Which one was this?
Now, the hospital name, I don't know. And we told them we hadn't had anything to eat in 24 hours. If they would give us just anything, can of this, can of that, just let us eat it and we'd be on our way. They were rather reluctant, and you can't blame them. They were scared. If we were caught in there, they'd all be in jail.
And they gave us a few cans of corned beef and some bread, and we cut it up the best we could. And we all had sandwiches, corned beef sandwiches, and they gave us a big pot of tea, a colander tea. So we had a cup of tea with it, and on our way, get away from the hospital so they wouldn't harm the hospital. Because once they seen soldiers going in a hospital, they could bomb it.
Mm.
So we got out of there, and we went up to Wan Chai Gap. That we found it. And that's where most of the fight went on for the next 3 or 4 days. That's where the brigadier and all headquarters got it, and they were wiped out, and most of our boys were. And then we were told to evacuate there, and we went up another road to what they call the peak. And on the way back, you were sort of leapfrogging over each other. One guy was playing rear guard, and you were going by, and then you'd stop in a house and cover all the roads so he wouldn't be hurt. And, well, I guess, sort of knew it when they said, well, we're all going up to the peak. You sort of had that feel, and this is it. But we didn't think of surrender. We thought, well, that's the last place we can go.
And what did happen after you did get to the peak?
Well, we were met by officers, British, and our own officers. We were told to lay our arms down over there and empty them. And well, I took my rifle, I emptied it, and I broke it, and I threw it on the pile, and that was the end. I figured, well, now what's going to happen? And then they gave us, like this other chum and I, we stuck together fairly close. And we went in and got a can of fruit and a can of meat. Now, I think I got click or something, and he got corned beef and the fruit, peaches or pears, cans. Something you hadn't seen in the hills for days. I don't know what they were saving it for, but we had stores of it. But you could only have one can of corned beef to three men. Well, what kind of fighting is that? See, this is going on for, well, you might say 17 days. And you were lucky. Yet we found out there was warehouses full of corned beef, food. One man to a tin, or three men to a tin. You see? So we had our can of meat and a pair of fruit. So this, I remember my chum, he's quite a joker. He's seen this Indian with a, well, it must have been a great big bottle of wine. Tall and thin. He says, how about the can of fruit here for that? And talk, so we talked to him, and he gave us a can of this bottle of wine for a can of fruit, peaches or something. So my chum, now we got our room. We only had our clothes on, so we laid on a bare floor there. We ate our meat, and we ate the fruit, then we drank the wine, and we slept till noon the next day. And that's how we found out it was all over.
How did you find out? Somebody just come along and...
Well, we knew before we went to bed. Because our officer told us, this is the end. I'll just turn your rifles in. And when you haven't got a rifle in the army, you're a soldier. You're a prisoner. All you're doing is waiting for fate then.
Mm-hmm. So what were your orders after you did hear about the surrender?
Just to behave ourselves.
And so you stayed here until the...
Oh, well, we stayed in this... I guess you call it an old barracks or part block, it looked like to me. It was empty anyway, there was nothing in it. And I hadn't shaved then in 12 days. And then they hand us an old razor and blade and says, go, you two go down and shave, now it's your turn. Shave what? See? What am I going to shave for? I figured I was going to get a bayonet tomorrow, I'll be the next practice. That's the propaganda we heard. So, never mind, we had to go down a cold stream that was running through there and shave the best you could with a dull braid after 43,000 men to shave with it, you know. Oh, we got a wash and a shave. And we went back, and then we found out there was a keg of rum. Oh, not a keg, it must have been 6 kegs of rum in the ketchup. No one could touch. And you were prisoners. What are you going to do, give it to them? So my chum and I, we figured out a scheme, and about four other guys that joined us, and we had our water canteens. We went in and took some. Filled all the canteens with rum. That was ours. No one knew we had it after. And they found out it had been broken into. Oh, we were going to be court-martialed and everything. The whole outfit. Going to be court-martialed. This is our officers. Breaking in the kegs of rum. You know, you're going to give it to the Japanese. But don't you drink it. Well, this is going on and on. Because we hadn't tasted good water for, I'd say, 16 days. The only time you could wet your whistle is you hit one of these English homes. And they always had cases and cases of gin down there. Well, after about 3 or 4 days of this, you got tired of gin. In fact, today I won't touch it. And it got to the point you'd gargle in the morning with it and spit it out, and that was the water.
So when did you finally meet the Japanese and were taken prisoner?
Oh, I would say about... Oh, we were prisoners that day. They had us surrounded. We were prisoners right there. But they never came up. I would say for about 3 days after.
And then what finally did happen? Did they?
Oh, they just marched us back down through into Hong Kong itself, the town. And on the way we stopped overnight, and I forget what church it was. They says you could sleep in here tonight. This is as far as you're marching, and that's it.
Was there quite a few men in your group, or were there just a few? Have they gathered some from other areas too?
The whole area congregated on the peak. Mm-hmm. The only ones that weren't with us were the Montreal ranch. They were on the other end of the island, done the same thing to. They just separated us and got us to the highest point, I guess, or to the point.
Now, what happened? You stayed in this church overnight.
And then we were on the march again the next morning.
And whereabouts did you go?
Well, we went right through Hong Kong onto what is called North Point Camp. Mm-hmm. And they kept us there for 3 or 4 months, maybe 2 months, 3 months.
What was life like in North Point Camp?
Hungry.
What was the food like?
Well, all you got is rice.
How many times a day?
Well, if you're lucky, you got it. Well, I was fed it twice a day, I'd say. Morning and at night.
And was there any other food at all? Or any, did they make tea or anything?
Oh, like tea. Oh, yes, you always had a cup of tea with it. But if you call it tea.
What was it made from?
Well, I would say some days it was what they call green tea. You know, like the Chinese drink a lot of green tea. Mm-hmm. They just walked through and confiscated everything when they went through. And they gave us that because they enjoyed it. And then we had a lot of black tea.
What was this made from?
Just like your tea. That's black tea, too. Sergeant Payne and a couple of other boys went over the wall. But we understand they didn't get far. Because the Chinese had turned them in. So there was no help anywhere, we found out, even from the people.
Where did you go after you left North Point Camp?
We went to Shamshipo. That's on the mainland. And that's where I caught diphtheria in that camp. That's where we carried out, I think, up to 14 men a day. Yeah, buried.
And what was the camp like? Was there a great difference in it between the time you were there before and and the present time?
Outside? No, I'd say it was just the same, except for power and so on, you know. Everything was cut off from me. And officers were separated from us. Some went to, I forget the name of the camp, it was uptown farther in another camp. But most of the officers stayed with us, our own officers. But they had huts of their own and so on and so forth.
Were the meals still the same at this camp?
No, it was just the same, rice and vegetables, that was it. You lined up and got your bowl of rice and a few vegetables, potato tops or so, whatever it is.
Was there any other sickness besides diphtheria?
Oh, yeah, there was pellagra. Beriberi hit us. Well, people were getting hot feet, that they called. I don't think they have a name for it yet. Then you got sore eyes. You couldn't see. You were watering so much. This was all part of malnutrition.
Mm-hmm. What type of treatment were you given for your diphtheria?
I wasn't given any. There was no more shots. So we just were isolated in huts away from everybody else. If you made it, you made it. And if you did, that was too bad.
So, how long did you stay at this camp before you... Were you moved again from Shamrock?
No, I never. I stayed at Shamrock. Well, I was moved later on, mm-hmm. after I got better. Because mm-hmm. they put me on a little fishing boat. There must have been about 300 men in that fishing boat. You couldn't even lay down comfortably.
Mm-hmm.
And they moved us to Japan itself.
Mm-hmm. Before you did go to Japan, were you put to work at all?
Oh, yeah.
In Shamrock?
Oh, yeah. We made the runway there.
So what was the daily work like?
Well, we had to go and make the runway, dig it up, and haul some men, mix it. And you didn't have automobiles. You carried it on your shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
See, after all these years, the English never even thought of making a runway. We had to make it.
How many men worked on this? Was it all the men that were in the camp that were...
All men available. All men that were available and able to work.
Mm-hmm.
They went. Because I went for about 4 weeks. And then I got to Syria, and then there I stayed till I got better. That took about 6 months.
And then you were put back to work again?
I was put back to work mostly around the camp. The runway would be finished by then.
Mm-hmm.
There was no more work to do, so we stayed around camp, between camp, and kept it going.
Mm-hmm. How did you find out about being moved to Japan?
Well, while in the hospital, you see, there had been about 2 other trips before us went. And we knew our turn would be coming up sometime or other in life.
Mm-hmm.
That's how we knew it was coming, because when they start calling out your name, and so many huts or names, now I forget how they done it, but we knew we were going next on the next boat.
Mm-hmm. And what was the trip like?
Well, I'd say it was damn rough. When you can't lay down, there's sick people in there, and because when you get about 300 men, there's an awful lot that can't get seasick. And it was rough.
Was it?
And it was rough.
Was there any stops made along the way?
Yeah, Formosa, or Taiwan, as they call it down.
Mm-hmm.
We stopped there, and the Japanese loaded a bunch of these melons and fruit on board.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave us all one, and that was a treat. And that's the only... And while we were in dock there, they got the water pump going, and we all had a good shower.
Mm-hmm.
Salt water showers. But it was refreshing.
And where did you land in Japan?
I believe it was Kobe. Then from there we got a train and we went up to Niigata. And that's where we worked.
And what type of work did you do?
Well, I was handling coal off boats or loading coal onto freight trains. And then after, I guess about 6 months or so, they moved so many of us over into another warehouse where we unloaded beans and cargo, oranges, apples, and that's where we got our strength back. We stole them all blind.
What type of food did you have in this camp? Was there any
just
difference?
Just the same. Once in a while you get some boiled dry fish or something with the veal at night and sort of flavored the rice. Potato greens, or these, what they call radishes or daikon. We had a lot of those.
And the sickness, was it even worse now?
Oh, yeah. Well, it was not as... We didn't have diphtheria. We had finished that. But there we contacted dysentery, diarrhea, contacted everything.
Was there many deaths in the camp?
Not as many as in Hong Kong itself. I would say there is literally none compared to Hong Kong. There, when you carry them out 12 or 10, 14 a day for weeks, that's an awful lot of men. But that was diphtheria that done that. But the other was mostly dysentery. And we had nothing but rest to do after that to get rid of it. They wouldn't give us medicine or anything.
Mm-hmm. How long did you stay at Niigata?
Until the end of the war.
Until the end of the war.
Yeah.
And, let's see. Near the end of the war, was there any change in the guards?
Oh, well, all through it, there was changes. Because, see, we were more or less, the way I can picture it, we were used as a rest camp for the soldier. And they moved a battalion, and they had blood in their eye. And you had to watch every move you made for a week. Then they sort of cooled down and found out you weren't going to do anything, and, you know. And then they sort of moved around to your way of thinking and with you. And on the whole, most of them were good, mind you. They caught you sneaking off or doing something. They wouldn't hesitate to give you a club in the head and say, what the hell are you doing? You see. And, but I found it like if we knew there was a change of guard coming, you had to be on your toes for a week. Because they had blood in their eye and they'd put a vein through you so fast it wouldn't have, you wouldn't know it. But after a week, they sort of mellowed and thought, hey, you know, walk with you, talk with you. Sort of like that. But they didn't hesitate to let you know they were the boss. And you just had to go along and live with it.
Mm-hmm. What were the huts like in this camp?
I'd say they were flimsy. Mm-hmm. They were put up, and they're just like a great big barn without stalls.
Mm-hmm. Were they made out of wood or
metal?
Wood.
All wood. That's where one of them collapsed. You see, we had four big huts.
How many men to a hut?
Oh gosh, about 100, 200 men. That includes Americans, Canadians, British.
Were they segregated at all, or
no.
Were they all mixed?
No, all mixed. There was no segregation at all. Mm-hmm. You lived with everyone.
What was done for recreation, or was there any time for recreation?
I guess we could have tossed stones around like baseballs and pretended. But you were so tired and weak after 6 in the morning till 7 at night, you were tired. You didn't feel like going and running around.
Mm-hmm. Were you given any days off at all?
Yes, I was given every odd day. Like my number there was 79. Well, any day that ended with 9, I had a day off.
Let's see. How did the Japanese treat their own men? Was it quite cruel to them?
Well, to us, we thought it was. But when you get back and look at them, and this is their way of life, well, I'd say no. They were good to their own men, in a sense of that. Like if I'd done something wrong, I'd be on court-martial, or I'd be on charges. To them, the officer just paraded them up there and slapped them. This was actually a shame to them, you see, to get slapped in front of his men. That was more that's as good as having a severe reprimand in our army. And when they slapped us, it just made you boil. We're not used to that.
How did you finally find out about the end of the war, or that the end of the war was near?
Well, when they start just smiling at you and treating you nice, and then you don't have to go to work the next day, you wonder what's coming up, and you can walk up to the gate, but they don't say anything, just don't go through the gate, you know, you wonder now, oh, something's up. You know, you sort of have that feeling, it's a sense.
Did any of the American prisoners, were there any American prisoners at this camp?
Oh yes, we had a lot from battalion. Mm-hmm.
And did they tell you that of the different battles that had happened and how they were doing?
No, we didn't know. We had radio for a while in Hong Kong, they found that, and mm-hmm. It just faded out of the picture. Mm-hmm. And then we found out we were getting a little newsprint there, but I think the officers made 90% of it up by how good we're doing, you know, courage and all this. Mm-hmm. And but I don't think they ever had a radio. Mm-hmm. We never did after we left there. And I know right in Shamshipo there, they found one radio, but that was the last.
But you didn't find out through any American prisoners that were brought in?
No, they were brought in like the same times we were. Mm-hmm. So they have no more knowledge of what's going on than we did. Because they're from Batana Corregidor, you see. They folded up a week later. Or in January they folded.
So there weren't any new prisoners after you arrived at Niigata? There weren't any more brought in?
Oh, just from Tokyo.
Just from Tokyo.
Yeah. See, the British then, they were being bombed out and burnt out by the Americans. And they moved all the prisoners into us. And I, well, actually, they were the hardest to get along with. They were the great person crybabies. Actually, according to the Americans, and they were always at loggerheads.
Now, how did you finally find out about the end of the world? Was a formal announcement made?
Just about a week after everything was going so nice, you know, we were getting some nice food in, more meat, more fish. Then they announced that the war was over, but we could not. We were forbidden to leave camp. And, I'd say around the end of August is when we first seen them come in. Well, they found us after, before that, airplanes. I think it was on the Enterprise. And they quizzed over our barracks when they found us, I'm telling you. It was deadly. Oh, I was more scared then, because knowing the end of the world was there, I wasn't going to die. They were dropping food through the huts, they were dropping it right on our laps. And I don't want any canned stuff, but they're going to drop it. And I was ready to leave camp right there.
Did the Japanese guards disappear?
No, they stayed till, they had to stand their post till the American officers came. And in our camp, I don't know where he came from, from an airfield north of us. They couldn't have sent a better man. He was about, to me, he looked like 10 feet tall. And I guess he was about 6 foot two, big 45 on his hip. And when you see him walk through the gate and brush these guards, and they saluted him. He just brushed them to one side, you know, this big hand, and walked in. Hat back on the back of his head, just like MacArthur would, you know. Yeah, could just pick. And then we were all standing with our mouths open looking at him. Then he come around and met us all. He says, "You're free, boys." He says, "Been getting to town?" "No, we haven't been allowed to leave." "You're what?" "Well, you can leave any time you want." You know, this big talk. And, I just looked at him there on a big 45, had a Colt automatic, and he didn't fool around. He went to the camp commander and said he'd commandeered about three trucks and a bus. That was ours. Anytime these men want to go to town, drive them. Pick them up and bring them back. That was his orders. He was really putting on a show for them. He wasn't fooling around and all this bowing and yes, sir, and you know. It was quite impressive, I'm telling you, after you had seen it for a few years.
Was there quite a large amount of supplies dropped by the American planes?
Oh, God, we left huts full. Japanese got that. We couldn't eat anymore. Clothes and everything was just dropped in the field behind it.
What was the feeling of the men between the time that they found out about the end of the war and the time they left camp? What went on? Did you sleep a lot?
I would say we just enjoyed ourselves. Talk about what's going to come. What's coming now? Because we remember the world as it was when we left home. And, we had a lot of fun. Even the Americans were friendly to us. And you had clean clothes, you had hot water any time you wanted. We made them work. They boiled water till it came out of the ears. We had a bath any time we wanted.
And how long was it before you left the camp, like between the time you found out about the end of the war and the time you did leave the camp?
Yeah.
How long was this? How many days?
Oh, well, I didn't leave till the middle of September. And I would say that's a good 2-3 weeks.
And how did you leave? Did you go by truck or by train?
No. There was a railroad track morning, say about a mile south of us. And we were told we're leaving in the morning, pack some stuff, anything you want. So, of course, the first thing you think of, you're going to take some food. You never think of the train load is full of it. And, I got another pair of nice clean coveralls and a white t-shirt, put that in my bag. And we all went, walked down there. We're going home. Didn't care whether we walked 14 miles, we were going.
And where were you taken?
We were taken to Tokyo.
And what happened there?
Yokohama in Tokyo. Well, we just walked into town and all these Japanese officers were there. They weren't armed, they weren't nothing. They were sort of interpreters for the Americans because there's every Japanese officer, there was an American. Mm-hmm. And they all treated us very beautiful. Gosh, welcome, old brother, you know. And I walked into this big warehouse it's a dock warehouse and docks. Well, what's facing you but a bunch of Red Cross women? Piles of donuts and coffee and milk. Something you haven't seen in for nearly 4 years. Well, before we could touch anything, we were told we had to go and have a shower again. We just had one in the morning. We had another one. Then they did put delousing powder all over you, and then they gave you another new uniform. And then when we got in there, the first one I went to, I said, well, lovely, old, I'll say nice lady. Looking at these donuts, and I just think, oh, God, if I could have a couple, she'd give me a couple. Sitting there having them, and a glass of milk. First time I ever tasted milk in 5 years. And then she come over after and said, would you like some more? I said, sure, well, no one else wants them. She bragged about 8. Donuts, I eat that. I had about 3 glasses of milk and about 12 donuts. I felt so comfortable. And they give the only thing that got me after all this, we have never had a cigarette all this time, and the first thing they hand you is a carton of cigarettes. Free. Gonna have it. Stand there, light it, then throw it out. Boom. Light another one. See how far you can get it going. You know, free. I've never seen this before in your life. We're like millionaires.
And what happened? Did they put you on a boat for a medical exam?
No. We stayed on the dock till the next morning, like in the warehouse. We didn't want to sleep. There's too much food around to sleep. Who wants to sleep? And fooling around with the American soldiers and the girls talking to them, first ones you talk to. Well, next day they floated us on a landing craft and took us up to this big boat. Gave us our bunk. Nice bunks. I was quite surprised. Comfortable. And that's where we went to Guam. From there, Holyoke, Tokyo, we went to Guam. And we stayed there about 2 weeks in Guam.
In the hospital there? Or
it's a form of hospital.
Mm-hmm. And were you given an exam of any kind?
Oh, yes. We were put through the regular routine. Examined all over, toenails, our eyes, our hair roots, everything. And then they were given new uniforms again. This time, we were given it more or less, I guess it was the Red Cross. And they gave me 2 t-shirts, white t-shirts, and a blue jeans. They wouldn't let you just take them. They had to fit them on so you look like something. And then they gave me my first pair of boots, shoes, the Oxfords. Beautiful pair of Oxfords they gave me. The camp was ours. Oh yes, they gave me a nice windbreaker. Beautiful windbreaker. That was mine. I was dressed just like Vanderbilt.
And where did you go from Guam?
We went to Pearl Harbor.
Did you go by boat? Or
yeah, boat. Everything was by boat. Mm-hmm. Till we hit Frisco. And there's where Pearl Harbor. We were given permission to leave boat or go on shore. Mm-hmm. There was a bar there, but we didn't have much of drinking at the time. And mostly looking around to see all the goodies, the chocolates. Never seen much of this. And then that's where I was in the bar there. And I had a white t-shirt, blue jeans, and one of these white sailor hats on. And they knew I wasn't a regular Navy man the way I was dressed. But that's all we had to wear, because everything we touched was Navy. And these people came up and asked us if we were from there, yeah, and the American people, couple, older couple, they had a car and they took us for a trip on the island. Well, they treated us just wonderful. Didn't cost me a penny. In fact, I couldn't have paid anyway because I didn't have any money. But they paid for everything. Anything you wanted to eat, anything at all. I said, those people really treated me nice. So as far as I can say for myself. Mm-hmm. In fact, some of our boys, I think, stayed overnight there. They missed the boat. But they were really nice to us, I'll say that.
And you left Pearl Harbor and then you went to San Francisco?
San Francisco.
And what happened there?
Well, we were on this. It's an island there now. I thought it was McDonald's Island. I don't know what the name of it was. We stayed there. And they split the island in half. Because their nieces were on the other side. And they thought if we met them, we'd start a war again. And these were all old barracks here, army barracks and everything. We lived in those, bunk beds, everything was beautiful. They were treated us really good. Mm-hmm. You could be an hour late for lunch and they still find your meals. You know, just like on the boat coming home. Gosh, beautiful the way they fattened us up so fast. And every time you went in for a meal, you had a pill. That's the only thing that bugged me, you had a vitamin pill.
And how long did you stay here?
And we stayed there close to a week before we even seen a Canadian officer. Then we were supposed to bring us money. So they did. They brought me $10. I'm supposed to spend $10 there for what I want. You know. PX was there. Mind you, I could go to a theater for nothing. I'd go to anything for nothing. It was all on the government. The American government. But the thing was, I wanted to buy things in the PX. So they were being big to us. They bring a payroll officer down to meet us in Frisco. They gave us $10. Let that last you. Big deal.
And where did you go when you left San Francisco, and how did you go?
We went to on a ferry across again. We got on the train, and we took a train right up to Seattle or North Point. No, I'm not sure. But we got on a Canadian boat there. And then it took us around the channels and up into Espinwalt, or Victoria.
Mm-hmm. And what happened there?
That's where we unloaded. We were home after about a month.
Did you go in the hospital there, or did you just stay in the barracks?
Just in the barracks. Mm-hmm. And there we got re-equipped with our own uniforms. They let us keep all our clothes that we got from the Americans. I brought them home. Because most of them were fatigue clothes, dungarees and so on. And they let us keep those, and they equipped us with our own uniform again, and gosh, we had badges, they were coming out of my pockets, I didn't know where to put all the badges, you see. Then these Red Cross ladies moved in on us, and said to bring our uniform jackets to them, and they saw all our button, you know, all the badges, flashes on, so we took them in, and these ladies sewed everything out, made us look good.
And how long did you stay here?
Oh, we stayed about a week, 2 weeks in Victoria, mm-hmm. before they thought we were safe to let loose. See, every day you had to go through a lecture on what girls were. See, we were mad. We were on sex start, you see. You had a lecture regular on girls, don't touch. You look up and don't touch, you know, all this stuff. They really thought we were mad.
And how did you leave Victoria? Did you fly or go by boat?
No, I went on train. Well, from Victoria, we took a boat.
Was it to Vancouver, the ferry. Was it?
We took the ferry into Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And they docked right at the train track, and we got on there.
Mm-hmm. And was there quite a few traveling together in the group? Or
the whole outfit went. I think we came home that time about 400 strong.
Mm-hmm. And what was the trip home like from Vancouver?
Oh, it was enjoyable. You're home. No one can say you're home.
Did you have the whole train to yourself? Or
oh, yes.
Were there other civilians on the
train?
No,
we had the whole train. It was our train, that was it. And then we stopped at, I know, well, first stop I think we made, I don't know, for somewhere in the mountains. And we talked to the civilians on the station there, and they had a real good talk with them. Got to jump on again, away you go. We stopped at Calgary, and oh, we had a lot of fun there. We stopped, I think, about an hour there. So a cab driver was there, and I said, can you get us a bottle? Sure can. And he went away. I don't know where he went. It was only 10 minutes. He came back, and he said, cost you $10 for a little one. They really rocked us. That was the only sore point on the way home. Where the hell are they? Out to get us.
And what was your arrival in Winnipeg like?
Well, it was very nice. I'd say they put on a very nice one. They packed the CPR station so full we couldn't get out. You had to wiggle your way through the people. They were all looking for someone else. And that's where all my family were. And by that time, your ringing went. I was darn nervous, you know. Meet so many people and so many questions. Where's so-and-so? What happened to them, you know? Some of them you knew, some of them you didn't. You knew what happened to some, and you didn't like to say it right out loud. Well, by that time, I was so reaming wet with sweat by the time I got the front door. And who's there but a guy? I don't know who the man is yet. He's my car's here at your service. Packed all my family in with me, and away we went. He drove me down Main Street, down Portage, and home. So I could just look at Portage Avenue again.
And were you given leave right away?
Oh, yeah, right away.
Got home?
They couldn't hold us. They knew they were wasting their time to hold us any longer. And then we were just given a week off and said to report at Fort Austin Barracks, and then we went there. And from that day on, there was just medical checkup after medical checkup after medical. And every time you went to the quartermaster stores and got coupons. I didn't know what coupons were at that time. Ration coupons, I didn't know what they were. Gosh, my mom had more sugar and butter coupons she could use. But every time you went, it was a habit. How are you feeling? Good. Do you need anything? Butter and sugar. Put them in your pocket, take them home. And at that time, like, clothes were a priority, suits. I had more slips for buying suits than anybody. Every time I went, I said, I need a suit. Give me a slip. You see? I didn't need them, but I got them anyway. They were so good to us, really, all the way down the line coming home. There wasn't anything. If you'd have asked for the crown jewels, they probably would have found out some way of getting them to you. That's the way I felt.
Yeah. And when did you finally get your discharge?
I got my, I got discharged April 1946, yeah. But then I was transferred from the Army into Deer Lodge Hospital.
And
the civil service then wouldn't hire you, because you were still under Deer Lodge Hospital.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you have to go into the hospital to stay in the hospital?
Oh, yeah, for a while. But they always give you leave in the evenings, and then we went out to Portage La Prairie for rehabilitation, you know, and all this. Mm-hmm. But we were always given the evenings off to go to town or do anything you wanted. Then we came home, and they discharged me in November of 46.
Mm-hmm. And did you return to work? Or?
I had applied 5 times since then. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't hire me. I was still under Army rules, mm-hmm. Deer Lodge. Then in February the 1st, 1947, they phoned me up and says, come on, you've got a job for you.
This was the government, wasn't it?
Government. Mm-hmm. And I've been with them ever since.
And what department and what position?
At that time, I was with, I'm still with them, actually, Department of Transport, mm-hmm. in the weather office. And I'm still with them.
In what position is this?
Just observer plotting. So, 25 years I've had a great time. They've looked after me very well. Outside of the government themselves, I sort of hold a sore spot to them. Like, they gave us all $1.25 a day for working for the Japanese and that.
Then we found out that the Japanese had paid them $2.50 a day for every man, and they're still holding back $1.50 of mine somewhere per day. And that is a sore spot with most of us. The Americans got all their money, the British got all their money, but we didn't.
What is your opinion of the Japanese? Has it been changed at all because of the war?
No. I'm a soldier. I'm an adventurer. I asked for it, I volunteered, so what? I mean, you can't be mad at the people. Mm-hmm. Mind you, I think, after I get back and read what they've done here, oh yes, they did do wrong. But at that time, who's going to think straight? See, they were enemies now. You can't tell who is going to be an enemy, who isn't. I can see why they've done it, but it was wrong. They could have curtailed them in other ways, outside of just confiscating everything and moving them. But, I mean, that's the way things are done during a war, and hostilities. You've got to accept it, just like I did accept my fate.